July had proved a disastrous month for Germany. Extraordinary resilience meant there was no collapse. But German strategy by now amounted to no more than fighting a protracted and tenacious rearguard action against hugely superior forces and hoping that the grand alliance of capitalist Britain and America with the communist Soviet Union would fall apart. With the gulf between German and Allied resources widening inexorably, the writing was on the wall. A sign that the tables had been turned was the Soviet taking of Kiev in November. That same month at the Tehran conference, Allied leaders agreed that Britain and the United States would launch an invasion of German-occupied Western Europe the following year. The successful Allied landing in Normandy on the 6th of June 1944, D-Day, and 2 weeks later, the huge and devastating breakthrough by the Red Army in Operation Bagration, opened the third and final phase of the war in Europe that ended with the German capitulation. This was the bloodiest phase of all. A quarter of all the European dead of the war, equivalent to the total military dead of the entire First World War, can be accounted to these months. Most British and American military deaths, a high proportion of Soviet deaths, half of all German military deaths in the entire war, and a majority of civilian deaths, occurred during the last 11 months of the conflict. Many of the civilian dead were the victims of Allied air raids that laid waste to German cities in a crescendo of devastation in the closing months. The destruction in February 1945 of Dresden, with the loss of 25,000 mainly civilian lives, stood symbolically for a terror from the skies that rained down on German towns and cities as air defences collapsed. British planes dropped more bombs in March 1945 alone than in the first 3 years of the war. German losses in the east during and following Bagration dwarfed those at Stalingrad or in any other battle and couldn't be made good. Germany fought on to the very end. Fear of conquest by the Soviet Union, in awareness of the horrors the German soldiers had perpetrated on Soviet soil, intensified repression of all dissidents at home, comprehensive controls by the Nazi Party and its agencies, the impossibility of organizing any resistance after an attempt to kill Hitler had failed on the 20th of July 1944, recognition on the part of Nazi grandees that they stood or fell with Hitler, and lingering belief in the dictator within the German military and civilian leadership, all contributed to the vain struggle to hold out when rationality spoke loudly in favour of surrender. However, it was by now just a matter of time. With the collapse of the German Eastern Front, Finland, Romania, and Bulgaria turned against Germany in September 1944. Romania and Bulgaria were occupied by the Soviets. Poland, with Warsaw in ruins following German destruction after the rising of August 1944, was in Soviet hands by the end of January 1945. After lengthy, intense fighting, Hungary likewise was under Soviet control by March. By then, the Western Allies had forced their way over the Rhine. The overture to the advance into northern Germany, taking of the vital Ruhr industrial belt, and relentless progress into southern Germany. The Soviet steamroller was equally unstoppable in the east, pressing forward to the Baltic coast and the Oder, poised for the final assault on Berlin that began on the 16th of April, 1945. The Soviet advance into Germany, and now its conquest of the Reich capital, had been accompanied throughout by horrendous cruelty towards the German population, the rape of countless women one of the paramount hallmarks of the savage revenge for the earlier unspeakable atrocities by the German occupiers on Soviet territory. On the 25th of April, the large forces converging on Germany from both east and west met at the River Elbe. Soviet and American troops shook hands. The Reich was split in two. Berlin was encircled the same day by the Red Army. By the 2nd of May, the Battle of Berlin was at an end. Hitler had committed suicide in his bunker 2 days earlier. A brief but bloody postscript followed before Grand Admiral Karl Dönitz, Hitler's chosen successor, finally bowed to the inevitable. Complete German capitulation on all fronts was signed in the presence of representatives from Great Britain, the United States, and the Soviet Union on the 8th of May, 1945. The most horrific war in the history of Europe was over. The cost, material and in lives, was still to be counted. The political and moral consequences would shape future decades. The bottomless pit of inhumanity. All wars are inhumane, modern wars especially so. Modern weaponry means that killing in warfare has become impersonal, as well as enormous in scale, with civilians increasingly drawn into the slaughter. The Great War of 1914-18 had amply demonstrated these characteristics. Terrible though that war had been, however, it was left in the shade by the bottomless pit of inhumanity into which mankind plunged during the Second World War. The unprecedented descent had been waiting to happen in a Europe riven by ethnic and class hatreds, extreme racism, paranoid anti-Semitism, and fanatical nationalism. Entering war driven by hatred and being set on eradicating, not just defeating, the enemy was the recipe for the collapse of all standards of basic humanity. This was widely the case among soldiers in the war in the East, though far less so in Western Europe. Total war was the ingredient necessary to convert such lethal antagonisms into actual mass killing on a scarcely imaginable scale. In all wars, battlefield killing takes on its own momentum. The Second World War was no exception. In the campaigns in Western Europe and in North Africa, however, the fighting was for the most part relatively conventional. In Eastern Europe, it was different. There, the cruelty, callousness, and sheer contempt for human life defies belief. There, the fighting was part of a racial war. This derived directly from the joint objective of colonial-style conquest and racial cleansing of the National Socialist leadership in Germany. The resulting hell on earth, not just for the fighting troops, but also for civilians, was primarily a product of ideology. That is, who should live and who should die was in the first instance an ideological question. The terror and killing inflicted upon the civilian population in Poland and during the Eastern War clearly reflected that from the very beginning. The clearest demonstration of the ideological priority was the singling out of Jews, among all the countless victims of the extreme violence, in what soon turned into all-out genocide. Ideology nevertheless went hand in hand with economic imperatives. This was already plain within Germany itself, in the so-called euthanasia action that began in 1939. This was primarily directed at the elimination of racial degenerates, an essential principle of eugenics. Hitler had earlier said that any such action would have to await war. In October 1939, he backdated his signed secret authorization of the euthanasia action to the 1st of September, a a clear sign that he saw the start of the war as a moment to begin such a fundamental breach of the basic humanitarian principle of the right to life. The action was equally secretly halted in August 1941, after knowledge of it had become public and led to its denunciation by the Bishop of Münster, Clemens August Graf von Galen. By then, some 70,000 patients of mental asylums had fallen victim to it. This total exceeded what the doctors had foreseen, despite their recommendations of patients deemed suitable for the euthanasia action. The halt order of August 1941 was, however, by no means the end of the process of exterminating the useless mentally ill. Their killing now moved into the secrecy of the concentration camps. The victims of the euthanasia killings are estimated to have numbered over 200,000 in all. Doctors and nurses were heavily implicated in the deliberate killing of their patients. Although the killing of the mentally sick was ideologically driven, it also aimed to make economic savings by removing those deemed to be useless lives. Precise calculations were made on the savings to be achieved. The mentally ill are a burden on the state, was how the head of the Hartheim Asylum near Linz in Austria put it. The steps towards genocide against the Jews also had an important economic component. When it became obvious that the mass cleansing of Jews from the conquered territories, at first taken for granted, couldn't quickly be attained, the ghettos established in Poland became highly profitable enterprises for the German occupiers. As a result, some of those running them later, when Jews were set to be deported to their deaths, didn't want to see the ghettos closed. But what about the Jews who were unable to work? Already in July 1941, the head of the German security service in Posen, within the German annexed part of Western Poland, was suggesting that since the Jews can no longer all be fed, thought should be given to finishing off those Jews not capable of working by some sort of fast-working preparation. 5 months later, Hans Frank, the Nazi boss of the central German-occupied Polish zone, known as the General Government, when outlining the urgency of exterminating 3.5 million Jews in his domain, told his underlings that the Jews were extremely harmful to us through the amount of food they gorge. Later, when the Jews were being murdered in their millions, the biggest of the Nazi concentration camps at Auschwitz, in another part of Poland, Upper Silesia, combined extermination with industrial profit. The huge complex included 28 sub-camps, industrial installations operating on the slave labour of 40,000 prisoners, generating in all about 30 million marks of profit for the German state. When the prisoners were no longer fit for work, they were sent to the gas chambers. Ideology also blended closely with economics in the way the German leadership viewed conquest and occupation. Securing food for the German population was imperative. The turnip winter of 1916-17 had gone far towards breaking morale during the First World War. There could be no repeat. It was immaterial if the rest of Europe starved. It was taken for granted that between 20 and 30 million Slavs and Jews would die of starvation from German occupation of the Soviet Union. The only consideration, Goering told Nazi leaders from the occupied territories, was that there should be no German collapses from hunger. There were cases of cannibalism among the desperate Soviet prisoners, sometimes crammed together so tightly that they could hardly move, even to relieve themselves, and dying at a rate of 6,000 a day. Of 5.7 million Soviet prisoners of war in German hands, 3.3 million died a terrible death from starvation, or related disease from lack of food, or the freezing conditions. Meanwhile, Germany was taking 20% of its grain, 25% of its fats, and almost 30% of its meat from occupied Europe. Measly rations were eventually provided to the Soviet captives. Since the absurdity slowly dawned on the Nazi leadership of starving prisoners to death in camps, when labour was ever more urgently required for German war production. Even so, the majority of Soviet prisoners didn't survive German captivity. In the case of the Jews, there was an obvious contradiction between ferrying them halfway across Europe to their deaths, while there was an acute labour shortage. But here, ideology retained its clear primacy. Poland was, from the start of the German occupation, an ideological experimental ground. The western parts of the conquered country, West Prussia, the province of Posen, now renamed Reichsgau Vaterland, from the name of the river running through the region, and Upper Silesia were annexed to the Reich, not just restoring, but considerably extending the territories that had before the First World War been part of Prussia. These areas, though their general population was overwhelmingly ethnic Polish, were now to be ruthlessly Germanized. Central and southern Poland, the most densely populated part of the country under German occupation, was dubbed the General Government, Generalgouvernement, in colloquial usage dismissively referred to as Rest of Poland, Restpolen, and seen as a dumping ground for racial undesirables from the annexed territories. Hitler, as always, set the tone. It was going to be a hard racial struggle, he declared. There would be no place for legal constraints. All this added up to unbelievable misery and suffering for the subjugated Polish population, and the antechamber to genocide for the lowest of the low within that population, the Jews. Contempt for the Poles was widespread in Germany. Hitler himself described the Poles as more animals than human beings. He was far from the only German who thought that way. With few exceptions, members of the German army serving in Poland had no objections to the licensed killing, merciless persecution, and large-scale economic plunder that they witnessed or in which they participated. The Poles were treated as subhumans, far beyond the protection of the law, to be deprived of any form of education, imprisoned or executed on a whim, and no more than a reservoir of slave labour. Near-starvation rations were imposed. Polish culture was to be eradicated, all sense of Polish statehood extinguished. The Polish intelligentsia, as purveyors of culture and statehood, were to be liquidated or sent to German concentration camps. Auschwitz was a place of utmost terror for Poles long before it became an extermination camp for Jews. In the annexed regions of Western Poland, Catholic churches were closed and large numbers of the clergy imprisoned or killed. Public executions were commonplace, the victims often left hanging for days to deter others. But underground resistance was never completely crushed. In fact, it grew in size despite the horrific reprisals to form a substantial, extraordinarily courageous illegal movement that, however draconian the repression, caused increasing problems for the occupiers. Collective retribution frequently followed individual acts of resistance. One estimate, resting on far from a complete record, counted 769 instances that took the lives of almost 20,000 Poles in reprisal actions. Some 300 villages were destroyed during the German occupation. The terror even increased during the course of the occupation as the war fortunes changed. German hold over the country became more precarious and resistance more emboldened. There was never a moment when we didn't feel threatened, one woman recalled. Every time we left home, we never knew whether we would ever see it again. Everyone feared the roundups to seize people for deportation to forced labor in Germany. By 1943, 1 million Poles were working for the German war industries. Their relatives often had no idea where they were. Many never saw their homeland again. It had been rashly presumed that the forcible removal of Jews from the annexed regions could rapidly be achieved. Ultimately, the intention was to remove the Jews from the general government as well. Between 1939 and 1941, however, they were deported into, not out of, the general government. During the depths of the winter of 1939-40, over 100,000 Christian and Jewish Poles were given a few minutes' notice to pack a few belongings, then herded into unheated cattle wagons and dumped in the general government. Hundreds of thousands more followed during 1940. By March 1941, over 400,000 had been deported and a similar number sent to Germany as forced labour. The deportation of a further 831,000 was prevented only by the preparations for Operation Barbarossa. The deportations were intended to make room for the settlement of ethnic Germans from the Baltic and elsewhere. Jews were to be confined in a huge reservation in the Lublin district of southeastern Poland. At least, that was the initial aim. But the Germans had grossly underestimated the logical difficulties involved. Hans Frank was soon refusing to allow more Jews into his domain in the general government. With Nazi leaders pressing to have the Jews from their areas deported, but nowhere to transport them to, and millions more Jews in Nazi hands since the conquest of Poland, alternatives to a reservation in the general government became ever more urgently sought. After the German victory over France in 1940, the French colony of Madagascar was for a brief time considered as a destination for Europe's Jews. That possibility too soon proved impracticable. Deporting them into the icy wastes of the Soviet Union eventually emerged as a possibility during the planning of Barbarossa. Poland, after a mere 20 years of independence, had been partitioned yet again in September 1939. East of the demarcation line agreed by Germany and the Soviet Union for the division, the Polish population was subjected to a different kind of ideologically determined horror. Here, the aim was Sovietization, not Germanization. A social revolution was soon imposed on eastern Poland. The land was collectivized in 1940. Landowners were evicted from their property. The banks were nationalized and savings confiscated. Much industrial machinery was dismantled and sent to the Soviet Union. Private and religious schools were closed, the teaching of religion and history was banned, and the catechism, according to Marx and Engels, introduced. Eradication of Polish nationalism was axiomatic, as was the elimination of all who were imagined to pose a threat to Soviet interests. The Polish elite were particularly at risk. Stalin and the other members of the Politburo personally signed the order on the 5th of March 1940 to kill more than 20,000 members of the Polish elite in eastern Poland. Among them were 15,000 Polish officers who disappeared in May of that year. The corpses of more than 4,000 of them were discovered by the Germans in Katyn Forest near Smolensk in April 1943. Who killed them was long disputed. It is now beyond all doubt, however, that they had been shot by the Soviet secret police, the NKVD. The other 11,000 almost certainly suffered a similar fate as part of the registered total of 21,857 people executed under Stalin's order. Waves of arrests followed the Soviet occupation. Over 100,000 Polish citizens were seized, most sentenced to years of penal servitude in the Gulag, over 8,500 sentenced to death. Poles settled close to the former Soviet border were in special danger. In some places, local Ukrainians and Belarusians were incited to plunder the property of Poles and even murder Polish neighbours. Local militias spearheaded the violence. Those Poles seen, usually in a mere figment of the imagination, as a particular threat to the Soviet Union, were rounded up for deportation. The vast deportations were carried out with utmost brutality. Almost 400,000 Poles, by some estimates far more, were sent to concentration camps in the wilds of Siberia or Kazakhstan in sealed, unheated, windowless wagons on winter train journeys of up to 6,000 miles. Around 5,000 died during the transports. Another 11,000 were dead of hunger and disease by the following summer. One of the NKVD men involved in the roundups for deportation later offered an insight into his mentality at the time. "I was responsible for the deportation of one or two villages," he recounted. "Now I think about it, it's really hard to take the children away when they're really small. Of course, I knew that they were our enemies, enemies of the Soviet Union, and they had to be recycled. I regret it now, but at the time it was different. Stalin was much like a god for everybody, and all of his words were the last word on any subject. You couldn't even think that it wasn't right. One didn't doubt it at the time. Every decision that was made was correct. That wasn't only my opinion. We were all thinking like that. We were building communism. We were obeying orders. We believed." Unsurprisingly, given their intense persecution by the Germans, many Jews welcomed the Soviet occupation of Eastern Poland. They had also often experienced discrimination in pre-war Poland. The arrival of the Red Army seemed to promise liberation. Jews sometimes greeted their presumed liberators by displaying red flags. They not infrequently took up administrative positions with the Soviet occupiers, the readiness to collaborate prompting much resentment among Catholic Poles. When the Germans came to occupy the region after their invasion of the Soviet Union in June 1941, and discovered the corpses of thousands of victims of NKVD atrocities in jails in eastern Poland, they had no difficulty in whipping up hatred, not just for the Bolsheviks, but also for the Jews who had been widely viewed as acting in their service. In fact, most Jews had soon come to realize what Soviet occupation meant, and it wasn't liberation. Many had been robbed of their property, while intellectuals and professionals had been arrested in great numbers. A third of the deportees had been Jewish. The brutality of the Sovietization in eastern Poland had parallels in Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania after they were annexed by the USSR in 1940. The savagery of the German occupation of Poland had, on the other hand, no remote counterpart in the German treatment of occupied Western Europe. In Croatia, a newly created state incorporating Bosnia and Herzegovina, after the German invasion of Yugoslavia in April 1941, the Germans found others to do the dirty work for them. The regime they installed under Ante Pavelić, the leader of the Ustasha fascists, instigated a rule of terror that practically defies expression. His was a fanatical movement with probably no more than around 5,000 supporters before gaining power, but bent on cleansing the country of all non-Croatians, almost half of the entire population of 6.3 million. The aim of Pavelić was to solve the Serbian problem by converting a third of the nearly 2 million Serbs in Croatia to Catholicism, expelling a third and killing a third. It was lethal lunacy. Whether Pavelich was entirely sane, he said to have kept a basket full of human eyes on his desk as souvenirs, is perhaps open to doubt. There is, however, no doubting the sanity of most of his followers. Yet the atrocities perpetrated by his death squads, as they massacred sometimes entire communities, targeting Serbs, Jews, and Gypsies especially, with the aim of wiping out all non-Croatian influence, plumbed the depths of sadistic horror. In one instance, around 500 Serbian men, women, and children from a small town not far from Zagreb were shot dead. When 250 people from nearby villages gathered to offer to convert to Catholicism to avoid being killed, six members of the Ustasha locked them inside a Serbian Orthodox church and murdered them, one after another, by hitting them on the head with spiked clubs. Other orgies of killing involved obscene measures of humiliation and torture. Even in a region where political violence had long been endemic, such a human catastrophe had never been remotely experienced before. By 1943, the Ustasha had murdered around 400,000 people. The Ustasha were certainly able to exploit ethnic antagonisms in former Yugoslavia when they took over Croatia. But their gross barbarity spawned far more and deeper ethnic hatred than had been present at any stage before the war. It was also counterproductive for the Germans. In Croatia, the Ustasha had explicit German backing for their actions. This was unlike Romania, where the orgy of violence perpetrated by the fascist Iron Guard led the Germans, anxious for stability because of the importance of Romanian oil, to support their suppression by the Romanian leader, General Antonescu. Their atrocities fed both anti-Axis feeling and the growing strength of Josip Broz Tito's emerging communist partisan movement. With much of Eastern and Southern Europe already falling ever deeper into the pit of dire inhumanity, the German invasion of the USSR in the summer of 1941 began a wholly new chapter. The war in the East, Hitler's war, was drastically different from all preceding campaigns, even though the untold savagery during the German occupation of Poland since September 1939 prefigured the descent into boundless inhumanity in the Soviet Union, in Nazi eyes, the breeding ground of Jewish Bolshevism. Hitler himself was indispensable both in promoting and in authorizing the barbarism. But he was its driving force and radical spokesman, not its prime cause. He himself told his army leaders that the war in the Soviet Union was to be a war of annihilation. Communist soldiers weren't to be regarded as honorable adversaries. The German army leadership was complicit in orders drawn up to liquidate Soviet commissars on capture without trial and effectively to declare open season on the shooting of Soviet civilians. Unsurprisingly, given encouragement of this sort to act without mercy against an enemy repeatedly portrayed as bestial or criminal, in what the army's own leadership described as a struggle of race to race, extreme barbarism in the Soviet war was widespread from the beginning. It rapidly came to characterize the behavior of German troops. Inviting retaliatory barbarism by the Soviet defenders and a swift spiral of unconstrained inhumanity on both sides. There had been nothing like it during the campaigns in Western Europe, where the very speed of the conquest had meant that casualties, even among the defeated, were relatively low, and the treatment of the population in the occupied countries was far less harsh than in the East. During the attack on the Soviet Union, the destruction of human life was enormous from the start, and here, unlike the West, huge numbers of civilians were slaughtered as part of the assault. The war in the East was outrightly genocidal. It had been planned that way, months before the launch of Barbarossa, and with Hitler's express backing, the head of the SS and chief of police, Heinrich Himmler, and the head of the security police, Reinhard Heydrich, had seen the final solution of the Jewish question to be attainable by the deportation of all Jews in German hands, an estimated 5.8 million, into the lands to be conquered in the Soviet Union. There, they would have died through starvation, overwork, disease, or exposure to the Arctic cold. Since Germany couldn't bring the war to a speedy, victorious conclusion, the policy of deportation into the Soviet Union proved unrealizable. Nevertheless, the killing of Soviet Jews was an implicit part of the German conquest. Close to the launch of the invasion, four big task forces, Einsatzgruppen, of men from the security police were instructed to accompany the army and to eradicate all subversive elements. This meant, in the main, Jews. As the German army advanced into the Baltic countries at the start of Barbarossa, it had no trouble in finding willing collaborators among nationalists in Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, who saw the Germans as liberators from the yoke of Soviet rule. Tens of thousands of citizens of those countries had been deported to the Gulag by the Soviets when the countries were annexed in 1940. Soviet oppression had laid its heavy hand on entire communities. Jews had been prominent among the Soviet administrators and police. Many in the Baltic countries were prepared to believe that the Jews and the Bolsheviks were indistinguishable, that the Jews were responsible for their suffering at the hands of the Soviets. The Germans and their collaborators were easily able to whip up anti-Jewish hatred among extreme nationalists. Soon after the Germans arrived in Lithuania, within days of the start of Operation Barbarossa on the 22nd of June 1941, mobs killed around 2,500 Jews in pogroms. Lithuanian units helped the German security police task forces in their grisly operations, which, in the Baltic, even by Nazi standards, were extraordinarily murderous in the early months of the occupation. It was little different in Latvia, where the Germans, with Latvian assistance, had killed nearly 70,000 out of 80,000 Jews by late 1941. In Estonia, where there were very few Jews, local units working under German orders killed all 963 they could lay their hands on, and a further 5,000 or so non-Jewish Estonians for presumed collaboration with the Soviets. The task forces kept a careful count of their killings. By the end of the year, the task force operating in the Baltic region could proudly record with bureaucratic exactitude a precise total of 229,052 Jews killed, along with another 11,000 or so other victims. Far to the south in Ukraine, Jews had by then also been slaughtered in vast numbers. But unlike the Baltic, the non-Jews in the Ukraine, deemed to be the inferior Slavs, were themselves mercilessly treated by the German conquerors. As in the Baltic, Ukrainians had at first welcomed the Germans with open arms. "We were all so happy to see them," one woman remembered. "They were going to save us from the communists who had taken everything and starved us." The terrible famine of 1932 was still a searing memory. The heavy hand of Stalinist oppression hadn't receded since then. When the Germans invaded, many Ukrainians deserted the Red Army or disappeared to avoid mobilization. As the Soviets retreated to try to escape German capture, the NKVD emptied the jails by shooting thousands of Ukrainian prisoners. Countless Ukrainians were left to struggle as Soviet scorched earth measures destroyed livestock and industrial machinery. Within days of the Germans arriving in Kiev, on the 19th of September 1941, the city centre was rocked by explosions from mines the Soviets had planted, starting a huge fire that killed many and left over 20,000 homeless. There was then good reason for the deep and widespread hatred for the Soviets among the Ukrainian population, and little wonder that the Germans were welcomed as liberators. Only downright idiocy could have converted that into even greater hatred of the Germans than the Soviets. But that is what the German conquerors achieved. Even some ardent Nazi ideologues argued for turning the Ukrainians into allies and the Ukraine into part of a ring of satellites to ensure lasting German rule in the East. Hitler, however, saw the Ukrainians as nihilistically Asiatic, just like the Russians. He backed utterly ruthless domination in the Ukraine, a policy put into action by his representative there, the abnormally brutal Reich Commissar Erich Koch. The view of Himmler was that the Ukraine had to be cleansed for future German settlement. The fate of the mass of the Ukrainian population was intended to fall within the general plan for the East, which envisaged, over the next 25 years, the removal of some 31 million people, overwhelmingly Slavs, from conquered Eastern territories. This much vaster genocide couldn't be put into practice because the war turned against Germany. Even so, the occupation, in which the Germans were helped in their cruel repression by police units of Ukrainians, Latvians, Lithuanians, and other collaborators, was so brutal that it engendered an all-pervasive fear in the population. Corpses on the streets, arbitrarily shot by the occupiers, were a frequent sight. Victims of public executions were, as in Poland, left hanging for days as a deterrent. Incidents of sabotage led to reprisal executions of hundreds. Whole villages were burnt down for not providing requisitioned food or for allegedly supporting partisans. Whenever we saw a group of Germans, we would hide immediately, recalled one inhabitant of Kiev. One huge source of fear from 1942, with Germany by now desperate for labour for the war industry, was being rounded up for deportation to the Reich. It was seen as tantamount to a death sentence. Nearly every family was affected, as those deported swelled in number to a million by June 1943. The deportations and the brutality with which they were carried out served as a great recruiting sergeant for partisan activity. Out of an initially welcoming population, German occupation had created a nation of enemies. But the Soviets were also the Ukrainians' enemies. Ukrainian nationalist partisans found themselves in violent conflict not just with the Germans, but also with the Soviet partisans. One Ukrainian partisan later recalled what it was like. "The Germans just killed us. But with the Red partisans, the bestialities were different. They have this Asian way," so he put it, "of torturing people, cutting your ears and tongue off. But of course, we were quite cruel. We didn't take any prisoners of war, and they didn't take any prisoners either, so we killed each other. That was natural." Ukrainian Jews, numbering some 1.5 million, about 5% of the population, though around a quarter of Kiev's, unlike non-Jews in Ukraine, had naturally feared German conquest. Even in their worst nightmares, however, they could scarcely have imagined what fate immediately awaited them under German occupation. Anti-Semitism, often vicious, was widespread in Ukraine long before the Germans arrived. Once the occupation began, Ukrainian Jews found themselves within a friendless society facing a murderous onslaught from the conquerors. A small minority of Ukrainians did help their Jewish neighbours. A much bigger minority was ready to denounce Jews to the German occupiers or to join in massacres. Most Ukrainians, however, stood by and did nothing. Envy of Jewish wealth, property, and position played a significant part in Ukrainian antisemitism. So did, as in other parts of the East, the belief that Jews had been agents for Soviet oppression. When the Red Army retook Ukraine in 1943, the view was frequently heard that these Jews are here again. By the time the Germans entered Ukraine, not just Jewish men, but women and children too, were being slaughtered throughout the East. In the Babi Yar ravine on the edge of Kiev, in a colossal massacre over 2 days, the 29th to the 30th of September 1941, 33,771 Jewish men, women and children were mown down by machine guns. Tens of thousands more were murdered across Ukraine, in Belarus, and in other parts of the former Soviet territories in the autumn and winter as German conquest extended its hold. Genocide was by this time total in the East. It would soon be coordinated into a program for total genocide across the whole of German-occupied Europe. In January 1942, the target figure for the number of Jews to be exterminated in the final solution was 11 million, though the estimates of the Jewish population in the various European countries were sometimes highly inaccurate. The total included Jews in England, Finland, Ireland, Portugal, Sweden, Switzerland, Spain, and Turkey, areas not under German control but presumed at some future point to be incorporated in the final solution. The target couldn't be met. Even so, when the course of the war brought the killing to a close, around 5.5 million Jews had been murdered. Amid the immensity of the horrific slaughter of non-combatants during the Second World War, there should be no hierarchy of victims. Whether an individual was starved or worked to death, shot or gassed by Hitler's or Stalin's men, whether he or she was a kulak, a Jew, a homosexual, or a gypsy, of whom around 500,000 were murdered by the Germans. This was a person with loved ones, not an unfortunate casualty of fighting, but someone deliberately killed. None should be placed higher or lower in a ranking order. There were differences, however, in the motivation behind the killings and in the essential character of the murderous programs. No social or ethnic group other than Jews had been encapsulated in ideology, long before the war began, as a cosmic enemy of diabolical power to be eradicated. Only Jews were carefully slated for destruction through the machinery of a meticulous bureaucracy. No other people, not even the Sinti and Roma, demeaningly labelled gypsies, were then so relentlessly destroyed in a systematic program, not just in mass shootings, but increasingly in an industrialized system of mass annihilation. In the entire catalogue of destruction, devastation, and misery that made up the Second World War, the murder of Europe's Jews was the lowest point of mankind's descent into the abyss of inhumanity. The fires of the death camp, crematoria, were almost literally the physical manifestation of hell on earth. During the autumn of 1941, the killing of Jews in separate, murderous actions in different regions of Eastern Europe was initiated by local Nazi leaders, operating under a broad mandate from Berlin. They were inspired by Hitler's own drive to bring about the most radical solution to the Jewish question. These actions in Eastern Europe accelerated the move to total genocide. The move gathered pace that autumn because the aim of deporting European Jews to Russia, where genocide was already raging, had to be abandoned when the expected early German victory in the Soviet Union didn't materialize. With the mounting pressure stirred for months by Nazi leaders to declare their own provinces Jew-free, somewhere else had to be found for the final solution of the Jewish question. By early 1942, a program of mass deportation to killing locations in Poland was emerging. Mobile and stationary gas chambers were by now preferred to mass shootings as a killing method. Gas vans, resembling furniture vans, but modified to discharge carbon monoxide into the sealed rear compartment at Szelmano in western Poland, began operating in December 1941, and by the time they had finished, had killed about 150,000 Jews. By March and April 1942, Polish Jews were being conveyed to their deaths in the stationary gas chambers at Belużec and Sobibór in eastern Poland. Treblinka, near Warsaw, followed suit in June, the third of the trio of extermination camps that by the summer operated within Aksion Reinhardt, aimed at wiping out the whole of Polish Jewry. There was no labour component in these camps. Actually, camps is a misnomer. There were no residents apart from guards and the few prisoners temporarily held back as special detachments, Zone Kommandos, to do the dirty work of handling the corpses at the gas chambers and crematoria. The camps of Aksion Reinhardt existed for one purpose only, to kill the Jews sent there. Few lasted longer than a few hours after their arrival. When these camps were wound down in autumn 1943, they had overseen the murder of about 1.75 million Jews, mainly Polish. Around 2.7 million Jews were murdered in the year 1942, almost half of the entire total killed during the war. Most perished in the Reinhardt camps. The main killing centre in 1943-44, however, was Auschwitz. Unlike the camps of Aktion Reinhardt, Jews were transported to Auschwitz as slave labour, not just to die. Also, unlike the Reinhardt camps, the vast majority of Jews sent to Auschwitz from 1942 onwards came from outside Poland. Auschwitz was already an enormous concentration and labour camp, initially for Polish prisoners, when the deportation of Jews from across Europe, starting with Slovakia and France, then Belgium, the Netherlands, and soon extended to other countries, began in March 1942. The deportees were mostly sent to Birkenau, an auxiliary camp 2 kilometres away from the parent camp at Auschwitz itself, but vastly bigger. From May 1942 onwards, those Jews incapable of working were separated from those capable of slave labour and sent straight to the gas chambers, whose killing capacity was hugely extended when new crematoria, which could burn nearly 5,000 corpses a day, were built in 1943. By then, the tentacles of the genocidal program had stretched to the farthest corners of Nazi-occupied Europe. Even in the western outpost of the Channel Islands, the only possessions of the British Crown to fall under German rule, 3 Jewish women, 2 Austrian, 1 Polish, were deported, initially to France, then to Auschwitz. Their subsequent fate isn't known, but none survived the war. The biggest deportations to Auschwitz were the last, those of the Hungarian Jews, in the spring and summer of 1944, following the German occupation of Hungary. The Germans needed the labour and wealth of the Hungarian Jews, but economic motives blended with the ideological imperative of destruction. Hitler told his military leaders in May 1944 that the entire Hungarian state was undermined and corroded by Jews, who were a seamless web of agents and spies. Their destruction was essential to German victory. His military commanders responded with storms of applause when he told them that he had intervened to solve the problem, emphasizing that only the maintenance of the German race mattered. The consequence was the mass deportation to Auschwitz of the Hungarian Jews. By July, 437,402 of them had perished in the Auschwitz gas chambers. Around 1.1 million people were murdered at Auschwitz, about 1 million of them Jews, 70,000 Polish political prisoners, more than 20,000 Sinti and Roma, 10,000 Soviet prisoners of war, along with hundreds of Jehovah's Witnesses and homosexuals. The Red Army liberated Auschwitz's prisoners at the end of January 1945. Even hardened Soviet soldiers had been shocked in July the previous year when they had come across the part extermination camp at Lublin Majdanek, where about 80,000 Jews were among the estimated 200,000 victims. What they discovered at Auschwitz was worse still. But even now, the torment of the Jews wasn't over. About 250,000 camp prisoners, overwhelmingly Jews, perished on death marches in the final months of the war, as the remaining camps, first in Poland and finally in Germany itself, were evacuated as the enemy approached. Each of those sent to Auschwitz and the other death camps had once had a name. The bureaucracy of mass killing turned the names into numbers. For the killers, the victims were anonymous. It was a very modern way of killing. Primo Levi, an Italian Jewish chemist captured by fascist militia, who found himself by February 1944 sent to work in the slave labor camp at Auschwitz-Monowitz, recalled what it was like to be deprived of identity. It amounted to the demolition of a man. We had reached the bottom. He continued, "It isn't possible to sink lower than this. No human condition is more miserable than this, nor could it conceivably be so. Nothing belongs to us anymore. They've taken away our clothes, our shoes, even our hair. They will even take away our name." They did. He soon learnt that he was prisoner number 173417. The number tattooed onto his left arm. He commented, "This is hell. Today, in our times, hell must be like this." But some retained an identity beyond the concentration camp number, and they kept their human dignity even as they prepared to enter the gas chambers. Chaim Hermann wrote a remarkable last letter to his wife and daughter, truly a voice from the gas chambers, which was found in February 1945 beneath human ashes near one of the Auschwitz crematoria. He depicted his life in the camp as an entirely different world to any she could imagine. Simply hell. But Dante's hell is incomparably ridiculous in comparison with this real one here. He assured her that he was leaving this hell calmly and perhaps heroically. This will depend on circumstances. Not all were stoical. A poem written in Czech that survived the death of its author in Auschwitz epitomizes the deep anger at the perpetrators of the horror, the inner rebellion against the degradation and death, the feeling, surely shared by many of the victims, that a day of reckoning must sometime dawn. "And there are more and more of us down here. We swell and grow day by day. Your fields are already bloated with us, and one day your land will burst. And then we'll emerge in awful ranks, a skull on our skulls and bony shanks, and we'll roar in the faces of all the people, we the dead accuse." Hell on Earth's many meanings. For the anonymous Czech poet and countless others, It was difficult to find meaning in the pointless slaughter of so many innocent victims. Many Jews asked where God was while the boundless suffering and death was taking place. If there was a God, why did he permit such horror?